मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवो शिवोऽहं 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 शिवोऽहं।
Greetings and love. So beautiful to see all of your names coming up on my little web Excel sheet that interacts with as people come and go. And it's great to see your familiar names and some names that are not so familiar. And just to sense this sangham, which has formed gradually over time and continually adds new members, is actually nourishing all of us when we sit together. So, as we did last week, and for the next few weeks, we're going to be practicing different forms of tapas, swadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhan, which, as you've all figured out by now, are what we mean basically when we talk about sadhana. Some of them will be familiar, some of them will be continuations, because I think we all know that even though it's very interesting to do new meditations, it's also particularly powerful to keep coming back to the same ones, because that's when they go deeper. That's when they carve out grooves in your unconscious. They literally create neuronal pathways, or as we say, samskaric pathways in consciousness. And that's when these meditations really start to change you, to bear fruit for you. So this week, we're also going to work with the sutras that deal with the sources of pain, and also that includes the main sutras on karma. As you may know, the Yoga Sutra is actually one of the big textual authoritative sources on karma as it's described in the Indian tradition, the Hindu tradition. We're also going to look a little bit deeper into the kleshas, or that is, we're going to unpick a couple of the kleshas that we haven't dealt with, the afflicted tendencies that are the source of our difficulties in life. And we're also going to look at how karma works with the kleshas. So let's begin by finding a posture. And in, remembering the question that we worked with last week, what's the most important thing right now? What should we be paying attention to right now? So the answer that I would offer for this moment is we should be paying attention to our posture. This initial practice is a practice of attention. It's also a practice of surrender and devotion. But it really makes a difference if we start in our what we defined last week as our posture of tapas, where you very firmly ground the sitting bones in your seat. You inhale down to the seat, just giving your sits bones and the muscles around your buttocks another chance to release, to take the support of the seat. And then as you inhale, you allow the spinal column to draw upwards through the crown. And then you take the muscles, the scapular muscles, and you firm them so that you're actually creating a kind of a support for your back, and also using the scapular muscles to lift your torso, to lift your body up through the crown, and see if you can just for a moment sit with awareness of that posture and notice where you're getting tight, because that's one of the things that happens when we do tapas, we get tight. So remaining in the posture, just ask your muscles to soften. Not let go. Just to soften. As we get accustomed to this practice, it's so important in deep meditation, learning how to hold a posture while relaxing in it, while softening in it. So, holding the posture softly, not stiffly, we'll chant our invocations, the invocation to the eternal teacher, Shiva, the invocation to the primordial goddess and the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. There is a very beautiful version of these mantras that Nancy sent us, and that is up on the student area of the website, sung by an extremely beautiful young woman. So it's a visual pleasure as well as a sonic pleasure. And I suggest that you might want to use that one. She is singing some invocations that we don't chant, but she's also singing the ones that we do. So bring your hands into Anjali Mudra, please. We'll chant Om three times and then enter the mantras. Om. Shivaya Gurave Satchit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhavabhode Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsara Hala Hala Mohashantyai Abahu Purushakaram Shankachakrasidharinam Sahasrashirasam Shvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. Be aware now that you're sitting on the shores of the lake, Manasarovar, bottomless lake of consciousness, deep blue, filled with glacial waters that carry the memory of countless generations of yogis who sat beside it. And be aware that all of us are sitting around the lake with you. All of us who are here live and all of us who are here in our subtle form. And also be aware that there are other beings sitting with us, yogis, great beings, guides, masters, and perhaps some of the loved ones or people that you would like to invite to the lake. And as you let yourself settle into this deeply still place. Allow yourself to recognize that you're in a place where awareness becomes pristine and precise, where reality can be experienced at its most primordial level, and where the love that is the essence of this cosmos comes off the lake like mist and draws us together, embraces us in its folds. So at this moment, let yourself become aware of your heart space, the center behind the breastbone, what we call the lotus of the heart. And you might actually imagine your heart as a lotus if you have a visual imagination. A lotus made of light, a lotus made of rose gold light. And as the breath flows in, the inhalation touches the heart And it allows you to recognize and settle into the subtle presence that is your inner heart space, the lotus of the heart. As you exhale, the space around the heart gently expands. And in the center of the heart lotus, you find the presence of the flame of the soul, the flame of the jivatma, the individual spirit. And as the breath flows in, the sound hum flows into that flame, and the sound sa emanates from it with the exhalation. And now become aware of the flame in the heart of all of us. Each one of us sitting around the lake is holding within the heart the lotus of their heart, this same flame. And consider the paradox that every one of us is an individual flame, a unique soul, and yet it is the same light that shines in each of us. And with that awareness, imagine that you're holding in your hand a candle with the external form of that inner flame. And very gently, with a lot of reverence, you place the candle in the lake. And now ask that our practice this evening be of benefit to all beings. Ask that all beings, including ourselves, be free of suffering, both external suffering and internal suffering. Ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. Ask that all of us be free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. And ask that we know, as a felt experience, the absolute equality of all that lives. And now imagine that you take your ordinary mind, your, let's call it, karmic mind, and you place your mind on the lake. Feel that your mind dissolves into the great lake of consciousness, and just sit for a moment and feel the aftermath of that offering. Your mind is dissolving in the great blue lake of primordial consciousness. And the breath flows in, touching the flame inside the lotus of the heart. And the sound of the breath offers hum into the flame in the heart, and sa, expanding its radiance through your whole torso, up through your head and down to your belly, not with effort, just knowing that the radiance of the heart naturally expands if we let it. So, as I said, tonight we're going to talk about suffering, which in general I'm slightly averse to doing. I would much rather talk about bliss. In fact, for me, the discovery of bliss was the big turning point in my life. Before my initial spiritual awakening, I believed that suffering was my topic. It was what I knew about. I had a lot of insight about it. When I was writing a novel about the suffering that we experience in relationships, kind of thing that you write in your 20s. But after I had this experience that I've talked about very often, where I experienced love as the source of everything, as the ever-present support of everything, including me, I woke up in the morning, looked at my manuscript, and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I was supposed to be a novelist of pain, and I can't do that anymore. And it was a real dilemma, as it happens. I had to abandon my novel, which was fine. But it wasn't until much later that I started to realize and to have gratitude for the suffering, which was such a present part of my early life, and to realize that it really was the goad, and I know a lot of you know what I'm talking about, that prodded me into the journey of awakening. If I hadn't been suffering, I probably never would have started looking for an answer. And, this is the paradox of suffering. It's unbelievably painful and difficult. Some forms more than others, but none of them are fun. And yet, certain types of suffering are absolutely necessary in order for us to make progress on the spiritual path. I believe that it has to be the right level of suffering. If suffering is too great, it takes up too much space in the psyche to allow us to turn past it. But for people whose suffering is like yours, is the suffering of realizing the gap between what you know life can be and what you're actually experiencing, that kind of suffering is tremendously important and meaningful. One of the most important facets of the Yoga Sutra is what it has to say about suffering. And it is part of the brilliance of the text, I believe, because it's also one of the things that every spiritual text has to do. Every philosophical system and every religion has to answer the question of why we suffer. And also the question of, especially in the Judeo-Christian traditions, the problem of evil. And, this question, especially in deistic systems, especially the Western religions, the question is often asked, how can God allow suffering? How can a good God allow suffering? And that's been a huge problem for religions, because if you believe in a caring, omnipotent God, then you naturally wonder how he, usually it's he, can preside over a world that's so cruel and in which there is so much bad stuff going on. Now, as you know, if you were brought up in one of the Western religions, the fundamentalist answer is it's the fault of original sin. Adam and Eve displeased God. They disobeyed God, so that's why we have to suffer. But as humanity has evolved and religious ideas have evolved along with it, the explanations of suffering have also evolved. And many religious philosophers and theologians in the Western tradition take the position that suffering is how we learn and grow. And, you know, this position is called soul-making theodicy. In other words, God creates these conditions in order to hone our soul and spirit, make us strong and pure. So the idea is that what we think of as pain is actually a divine mechanism that's built into the cosmos. You know, sort of if you put your finger on a hot stove, you'll burn yourself, and then you learn not to put your finger on stoves, based on the fact that we learn by experience. Now, in the Eastern systems, especially Buddhism and Hinduism, this understanding about the nature of suffering is based partly on the doctrine of karma, which we'll go into in a bit of detail later on, but of course more essentially on the understanding of basic ignorance, avidya, which all the Eastern traditions believe is a fundamental problem that keeps us from realizing our interconnection with the source of life, as well as realizing our own beauty, our own intrinsic love. And every system, every particular system in Eastern philosophy has its own explanation of what ignorance looks like. And they all share some things in common, and not everything. So in Shaivism, in Tantric Shaivism, ignorance is seen as a feature of the process of manifestation in which the great soul becomes individual souls, thereby shrinking its powers and its bliss, and, you know, creating this situation in which we feel limited and consequently powerless and consequently in pain. In Vedanta, it's seen as the effect of Maya, the cosmic deluding power. The Yoga Sutras and Buddhism see suffering basically as a result of impermanence, of the fact that, you know, that everything is always changing, which we'll get into in a little while. And also, they consider it the result of the ego, the result of clinging to the belief that you're a separate individual soul. In the Yoga Sutra, or in Sankhya philosophy, ignorance, avidya, and the other kleshas are described as belonging specifically to the human mind. In other words, they're not part of the cosmos. And they say that the mind arises when souls come forth from within the ground of Prakriti, you know, the great inchoate mass of energy and dark matter, we could say, that is the foundation of this universe. And, you know, and so every, you know, and again, every tradition has its own story about how we take birth. And the story in Sankhya, of course, is based on the understanding of eternal recurrence, reincarnation. We're born again and again and again and again. That's in all the Indian systems. But it goes like this. After death, most souls spend a period of time in a kind of coma, a state of insentience, resting in the womb of Prakriti, the field of primordial matter. And what I find interesting about this, and why I decided to talk about it, is because there's a description in a book that you may have read that was on the bestseller list, or at least the New Age bestseller list, about 8 or 9 years ago. It was about a neurosurgeon who had a near-death experience, was in a coma for 10 days or 20 days, a long time. And he described his experience, and he talks about how at first, when he first came to consciousness in this state, he was embedded in, in matter is what he said. It was like being under the earth. He was just completely, it was black, it was encompassing. His state was very dull, and he stayed there for a while, and then he became aware of a light being who was hovering above him. And this light being, who being a Christian, he believed was God, which of course it may have been, reaches in and pulls him out of this hole he's in, and then takes him on a journey, which is the rest of his experience. So, and this actually is how Sankhya philosophy describes coming into birth. They say that at a certain point, divine grace, actually Ishvara, the personal form of deity, wakens the soul from this slumber and kind of brings the soul into its subtle body. And in this moment, the soul becomes aware of its real destiny, of its connection with the divine spirit, who is its mentor. It's quite a beautiful story, you know, the endless love affair between the great soul and the small soul. You know, and then as it slips into a new body, it loses that feeling of connection. And it takes along with it all the karmas and samskaras and the kleshas themselves that remained at the moment of death. So if you remember, the sutras say that kleshas only dissolve if we've done the work of attenuating them. Thus, the sages tell us, boy, you better be doing your klesha sadhana. So here's the sutra. We've talked about it last week, or I asked you to listen to the class I taught in the last course in which we went into it. I especially asked those of you who are here who are taking this course who didn't take that one. And the sutra goes, avidya smita raga dvesha abhinivesha kleshaha. Ignorance, the false sense of self-identity, attachment, aversion, and fear of death are the afflictions. And then the second sutra says, avidya kshetra mutare sham prasupta tanu vichino dharanam. Ignorance is the ground for the remaining afflictions. The kshetra, it's a wonderful word, the field or the ground, for the remaining afflictions, whether they are dormant, attenuated, disjointed, or active. And you remember, the kleshas can be dormant, in which case they're ready to sprout at this, you know, whenever there's a external trigger. They can be attenuated, which is the state of the yogi. They can be disjointed, which is what it is like for most of us. You know, we can become quite free of afflictions when we're meditating or when, you know, we're doing a lot of practice or just in a beautiful state. Or they can be fully active, which is the condition of most humans. So avidya, which again we discussed at length in class 5 of the last class, which means non-wisdom or absence of the quality of vidya, is the veiling energy that first of all walls off our knowledge of the soul's past experience, which includes our former lives, but it also includes our realization that we were once part of the wholeness. So avidya literally cuts the mind off from its source, which is pure awareness. And once we can no longer sense the light and the expansive intelligence of our true self, we start to look elsewhere for an anchor and a resting place. And I imagine it's kind of frantic. I can remember moments of great groundlessness when I just didn't know where I was, who I was, and how desperately I tried to find a ground. Often in another person, sometimes in food. When I smoked, it was often in cigarettes. You know, so when you think about it, so much of our life is an attempt to wall ourselves off from the feeling of groundlessness, the feeling of fundamental emptiness, which is actually the doorway into the self beyond ignorance. So in general, obviously, we find our anchor in the body and in the identity that we develop as a body and mind with all of its, entanglements, all of its connections, all of its opinions, all of its conditioning, all of its brilliance and all of its stupidity and everything in between. So, and this creates enough of a boundary, and it's very important so that we can function on this rather dense earth plane. But it also means that our bandwidth for experience gets radically narrow. So we become, we are literally cut off from the universe. The veil is a very real thing. And we're confused by the inequalities that we experience here, by the what feels like unfairness, you know, and so much else. And then our sense of self almost immediately, but, you know, develops as we come out of babyhood into toddlerhood and grow up. Our sense of self becomes more and more defined by how much safety, how much pleasure, how much support, how much approval, how much skill this individual body-mind can extract from the world or receive from the world or carve out in the world. And in other words, the rest of the kleshas, once asmita egotism has been established, the rest of the kleshas kick in and pretty much kick our butt nonstop. So the deepest samskara created by ignorance is doubt about our own worth. You know, this is utterly fundamental, and it arises from the experience of being cut off from the source. And, you know, what it means is that we don't trust our own insights. We don't trust our own intuitions. We always need validation. It's not true of everybody, but most people. And this makes us feel more and more powerless. So almost from the beginning, the feeling of personal identity is linked to a feeling of being powerless. Crucial to our sense of powerlessness is our identification with the fragile body and the ever-changing mind, neither of which we can fully rely on, even when we're young and strong and smart. So, I-ness, asmita, is a feeling. It's not just a story. It's not just an idea. It's not just mental identification. It's a felt sense. It's very hard to separate from your feeling that you exist. You know, in other words, asmita is basically the basic feeling of being somebody, and that feeling can be thought free. You know, as we look for when we do direct path inquiry, when we ask, who am I, we're looking for an experience of that thought free sense of being, unmediated by ideas. But it can also be identified with the wholeness of consciousness. And we can also identify with all that is, which is obviously, it's the state of self-realization that's described in the tantric path. My guru used to be asked all the time how to get rid of the ego, which is one of the spiritual seeker's first questions. And he would say, you don't have to get rid of it. Just identify your ego with God. Of course, what he said was Shiva, but I like to use the word God here, because for many of us, we're so used to identifying with our smallness that to think of identifying with yourself as God is really pretty scary. I mean, it's a big reach, right? So he would say, the ego of I am this individual is bondage. The ego of I am Shiva, I am God, is liberation. You can change it to I am all that is. Whatever arises is arising in me. You know, all these are, let's say, positive ways to eliminate the ego. And of course, this is the fast track to spiritual Shiva, to spiritual freedom. But I've always found that saying I am Shiva or I am the self or everything is within me is basically a form of sloganeering until you actually start to have an experience of it. And again, in my experience, getting to the point where that statement can feel true, I mean, you know, genuinely true, means that a lot of your kleshas have been attenuated. So because vidya is so rooted in us, what it actually means, practically speaking, is that we pretty much identify the self with the mind, with whatever's going on in the mind. And if you haven't done this self-investigation of looking at your thoughts and watching yourself cling to them, it's a really great practice to do. So In my experience, the feeling of limited I-ness, because it's so sophisticated, it's like one of those trick birthday candles where you think you've blown it out, but a second later it's reignited. That thought, oh my God, you're in deep meditation, and suddenly this realization pops up. Oh my God, I'm totally identified with awareness, or, oh, I've merged in the mantra. And it's so frustrating when this happens because, of course, it takes you out of that wide state and right back into the little ego. And the ego is extremely sophisticated. And one reason for that is because it's supported by all our memories. It's the samskaric backload, the samskaric backpack that we hold. It's lodged in our body, it's in our neurons, it's in our brain, it's in our gut, it's in our heart. There are some scatters of being an individual, of trauma, of what works to get people to like you, all that stuff. It's all in your body, it's all in your nervous system, and it's deeply embedded in your subconscious. So, and as we grow up, this becomes an entire web of identity, and because we associate ourselves with hundreds of incidents, reasons for resentment and insecurity and happiness and pride, and we can't always even remember them, but they're in our subconscious in the form of samskaras. And I've always been fascinated by an experiment that Warren Penfield, who's a brain surgeon, did in the 50s, where he was operating on somebody, and she was, for some reason, she was an epileptic. He had attached electrodes to different parts of her brain, and as the electrodes were stimulated, she began recalling incidents from early childhood, an entire sense memory of a moment in her mother's kitchen, and that was when people started to realize that memories are literally encoded in the brain. So they're also, of course, encoded in our nervous system as what Abhinavagupta calls the wounds of our impressions of thoughts and actions. Samskaras are wounds. And from those samskaras develop our often very, very rigid ideas of good and bad, of what's virtuous and what's sinful, and especially what we like and what we don't like, our attachment and aversion. So I think attachment and aversion are pretty obvious to most of us. Avidya and asmita are the water we swim in. Attachment and aversion are pretty identifiable, and they really are the main motivators of what we think, say, and do. And the thing is that we generally feel fairly positive about our attachments unless, we lose something. And the word attachment, at least in English, is essentially a synonym for love. In general, we valorize attachment. A major doctrine in contemporary society is called attachment theory, as many of you know. And the idea is that having a lot of loving attachments, having secure attachments in early childhood and for the rest of your life is the basis for a healthy life. And, there's a lot of truth in that. We're mammals. We're intrinsically social creatures. So having a lot of loving attachments is a joyful thing. But we tend to recognize its negative side only when it manifests as excess or when we lose something. So codependency, jealousy, possessiveness, refusal to share, greed, hoarding, consumerism, inequality of wealth and opportunity, they all come from, to some extent, from attachment. And what's problematic, of course, about attachments, well, obviously, is that we define ourselves by them, and if they are taken away, we feel that we ourselves have been attacked. There's a famous yogic story which some of you may remember, about a guy who was driving through the Santa Cruz Mountains in the 1970s. And in those days, there was, off the side of the highway, there was a big, famous biker bar. And there were always a lot of hogs, big, big bikes parked outside it. So this guy gets out of his car, and he goes over to one of the bikes, and he starts to examine it, you know, feeling the chrome, testing the handlebars. And suddenly this big biker dude comes barreling out of the bar, and he says, "What are you doing? You touch my bike, you touch me." And, you know, it's a great yogic story about attachment. And it's, you know, it's one of the causes of wars and a lot of other bad stuff in the world. Aversion, on the other hand, is a lot easier to dislike because it manifests as obviously painful emotions like anger, cruelty, hatred, resentment, tribalism directed at others. And also, perhaps most painfully for many of us, as our tendency to reject certain qualities and traits ourselves, often to the point of denying they exist because our aversion is so strong. And of course, one of the best ways to discover the kleshas that drive you, particularly these kleshas, is to really look at somebody whom you actively dislike or disapprove of. And we all have people like that in our lives, even if we're very good souls and, you know, work on our attachment, our aversions. Generally speaking, I would say, in my experience, almost without exception, the thing you really dislike in another person is something you don't allow or accept in yourself. So, you know, one of the very productive ways to do shadow work, psychological self-inquiry, is to actually look at someone that you hate and consider what the qualities are in them that you share, and that will start to give you a sense of what your own unexamined shadow might look like. So, Pandit Rajmani, in his commentary on these sutras, says that actually acting through the influence of the kleshas causes us to wear out our body and senses. You know, in Ayurveda, the understanding is, again, many of you know this, is that if we feed our bodies properly, if we're vigilant about how we use our senses, and especially about what thoughts we allow into our mind, we can maintain health and vigor almost indefinitely. But most of us don't get this message. And in a society in which just surviving can take all the energy we have, it's not hard to get more and more depleted by our own lives. So, and the older we get, the more our life experience creates concepts about our limitations, and the more the regrets, remorse, self-justifications that we've accumulated begin to come into the forefront of our mind, and the more vulnerable we feel to change. So before we get further into that depressing topic, let's find our posture. So we're doing tapas posture, really grounding through the sit bones, lifting up through the scapular muscles, allowing the shoulder blades to come onto the back, letting the crown of the head lift upward towards the ceiling. And beginning to allow the breath to flow in and out as easily as possible. As much as possible, feel that the breath is falling into your body, drawn by the diaphragm, but not by making a great effort. And then just flowing out of your body with the exhalation. Now letting the breath fall into the heart. Become aware of the heart lotus. The lotus made of light and love, which you might experience quite visually or might just tune into as a subtle presence in the center of your body. And be aware of the radiance in the heart of the lotus, whether you see it as a flame or just as a sense of illumination. Realize that as you take refuge in the heart lotus, you're taking refuge in the light of your own soul, your own deepest self. And as the breath flows in with hum, it's offered into the flame in the heart. And as the breath flows through the heart with sa, it spreads the radiance through the body. And reminds you subtly that who you are as an individual is that flame. This is your form, your subtle form. The Sanskrit name for the fifth klesha, abhinivesha, is usually translated as fear of death or clinging to life. But when you take the word apart, the etymology of the word is really interesting. The prefix abhi means from every direction and point of view. The middle syllable ni means totally, completely. And vesha means penetrating. So, in other words, that word indicates that the fear of non-existence, which I call the fear of nothingness, really penetrates every part of our life completely, including every part of our mind and body. Vyasa, the commentator in the sutras, says that we've all died before many, many times. We have memories of losing everything that we believe is us. And so our fear of death is supported by memories of dying. But I have to say, when I first experienced full-blown abhinivesha, the fear, the way that fear spoke itself, I was about 7, so the idea of dying was not really part of my structure at that time. But what I was really scared by was the idea that I could have not been born. And then where would I be? It was utterly terrifying. And, you know, perhaps when we're young, the fear is of not having ever gotten to be here. As we're older, as we get older, of course, that's when we start to realize that we're going to go. For many of us, this suggests that in death we face nothingness. So, you know, it might also feel like the test of how well we've lived. But if you've ever been overwhelmed by this fear of annihilation, really gripped by it, you know how intense it is. And it's such an overwhelming emotion that most of us resist it with all our might, which means that we often resist looking at our own health, at our own bodies, and fully facing the fact that in order to remain healthy, we actually need to consider the possibility that we could actually die. And I think that one of the things, as you know, about the lockdown is that it brought this fear of death right into the front of our minds. And it also gave some people, certainly not everybody, but it gave a certain group of people the luxury of slowing down a little bit. And that led to a recalibration. I'm reading now that people are starting to say that they don't want to work the way they considered normal before the lockdown. You know, they want to work less hours. They want to have a more leisurely life. They want to have more time to just notice the moments. And what many of us have been able to see, certainly it's been true of many of the people I know, is how much we are damaged by the belief that we're alone and unprotected and unconnected. You know, we call that loneliness, but it's actually a much more existential feeling of being alone. So, and the Upanishads say that wherever there is separation, there is fear. That feeling of separateness that starts as avidya, the covering over of our inner light of awareness, ends in the debilitating fear of losing the tiny ground that we've been able to carve out for ourselves. You know, for so many of us, the normal worries about paying bills and covering the rent have been magnified. And what happens when you're very worried is that it actually takes up so much space in your neurophysiological system, in your brain, that there's less and less bandwidth for making good decisions. So, and this is an extreme version of something that actually is the state that most of us live in when we haven't really looked into our experience of the kleshas and our samskaras. The life we live under the sway of the kleshas is a life that wears us down. And I want to read you, this is a list that Pandit Rajmani has in his commentary on one of these sutras. It's from the Brahmanda Purana, and it's a list of all the negative effects that come about as we go through our life impelled by the poisons of the kleshas. They include torpor, you know, that kind of stuporous inability to get moving, the inability to let go of painful thoughts and feelings, self-pity, disturbed sleep, restlessness, powerlessness, and lack of self-trust. Maybe you recognize a couple of these. Maybe you've experienced one or two of these sometimes. And he points out, which many of you can attest from your experience with older family members and even with yourself, these qualities often increase as we age. So there you have, you know, the number one rationale for why we need to work with our negativities while we can. And, of course, one of the primary ways that we do this is by becoming aware of what it is that supports us. Ishwara Pranidhan. So find your posture. Really make the effort to let the muscles lift you up through the crown. And as you follow the breath of hum and sa, sense the breath flowing into the heart lotus, opening up your connection to the radiance in the center of the heart. And now as you allow the breath to open up the heart inside the body, begin to feel that the inhalation draws your attention backwards as though you could actually breathe out through the back of the heart, through the back of the body, and recognize that behind your body is the presence of the great heart, which for some of us is experienced as a feminine presence, some of us as a light, some of us as a feeling, some of us as a masculine presence. Just sense that presence, which I like to call the divine backrest, embracing you from behind. And let the breath flow through the heart lotus, recognizing that the breath can connect the flame of your individual soul with the great light of consciousness and love, which is the support of your life, which is embracing you from behind. And as you allow yourself to inhale into, in through the heart, into this presence behind you, and to exhale, deepening your sense of that presence, holding and surrounding your body, see if you can, with the inhalation, offer your body into that presence. And then with the exhalation, feel that this presence flows radiance from behind you, in through every pore of your body, literally transfiguring your body with its light. You know, among the hidden samskaras that we get to deal with and that I think we are getting to deal with in a much more conscious way in our time is the generational traumas that are carried in the family DNA and in the DNA of society. And, of course, we see this all over the world. We see it very much in the U.S. right now, as these radically different stories about reality and the reality that we're seeing in our cities and states plays out, partly because of the fractured information ecosystem, but also because our generational and family history has, and the samskaras associated with them, has created this backlog of assumptions. And we're getting to see, because everything is so out front, exactly how it works and how they cause clashes and how they cause misunderstanding and blaming others and, you know, victim blaming and every form of, you know, painful klesha-driven behavior. And this is one of the, you know, the basic laws of karma, that our samskaras and our kleshas can remain dormant until an external situation comes along and triggers them, and then, oh my God, they all get activated, and this is when we have wars, this is when we have broken friendships, this is when we have divorces, and, you know, this is when humans clash in terrifying ways. It happens through the operation of the kleshas, the unexamined, unworked with kleshas. And, you know, if you think about this, you know, you realize that important as it is to deal with external inequities and, you know, everything that goes with them on a physical, mundane level, and I do believe it's incredibly important, it's not going to really work unless we're also dealing with their inner manifestations, with the samskaras. And I do, you know, I do think that this is why the awakening that's going on in our society is so important. You know, it might just be what saves us. The thing is that being able to understand the impact that internal samskaras have on our experience of external events is actually one of the most important fruits of Swadhyaya, and it's one of the reasons why the Yoga Sutra sage asks us to work with these issues. And of course, what we also understand in the chain of bondage and liberation, the actions that we commit under the influence of the kleshas create situations that we have to live out now or in the future. And this is what Patanjali explains in Sutras 12, Book 2, Sutra 12, Sutra 13, and Sutra 14, very famous sutras on karmas. And here they are. Drum roll, please. Dun-da-da-da. I don't know why it is that karma is so incredibly fascinating, but it definitely is. So, klesha mulaha karmashaya drishta adrishta janma vedaniyaha. The reservoir of karma is rooted in the kleshas, the afflictions, and is to be experienced in seen and unseen lives. And then the next one, sati mule tadvipako jatyayurbhogaha. As long as the root cause, the five kleshas, persist, karmas must bear fruit, and that fruition determines our birth in a particular species, our lifespan, and our life experience. And here we go. Te halada parita pafalaha punya punya hetu vat. These karmas, which determine our birth and general experience, are accompanied by pleasure and pain, for they are infused with virtue and vice. In other words, they are infused with the results of our selfishly and unselfishly motivated actions, which is what this comes down to. So please, you know, one of the things about talking about karma is that it often can get us into our kind of sin and punishment childhood relationship to the universe. So this is not the intention. It's not supposed to make us feel bad. It's just supposed to make us take our life a little bit more seriously, even while we're laughing. So the karmashaya means the reservoir of karmas. I call it the karmic backpack because it's something that we drag around with us. You know, it's just like it clings to our back no matter what. As the accumulation of memories, impressions, and impulses that has lodged within us, not just over this lifetime, but over countless lifetimes, which is fairly mind-blowing if you really consider it, if you don't just think, okay, spiritual cliche of, you know, Indian philosophy. You think about it, you know, how many lifetimes and how many impressions you could be carrying that you don't even know about. So it's, depending on the school, the Karmashaya is said to be located in different places. For instance, in the tantras, it's often said to be in the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel. And this becomes very important, of course, once Kundalini is awakened, because one of the things that Kundalini does is rise through the Sushumna, through the central channel, clear out the chakras, which are repositories of the Karmashaya. Another view, more of the Vedantic view, is that the Karmashaya is in the causal body, the body of unknowingness, of darkness that we inhabit in deep sleep. And in those very deep, dark meditations that we sometimes have. And I think that many of you have had this experience that when you go into this kind of totally deep meditation, where it's almost like you go out, you can come out of that meditation and be sleepy, which means it was a dull, you know, sleep state, happens to all of us sometimes. Or you can come out of it feeling quite refreshed. And that's when you know that your meditation has gone into the causal body and that it has wiped out samskaras. That's one of the things that it will do. So one of the big questions, of course, is how much of my life is driven by karma and how much is genuine choice? And the sages of both Hinduism and Buddhism basically agree that until you begin to wake up and practice yoga, that it's mostly karma, and that even your ability to practice yoga, your interest in spirituality, is the result of past karmas. And this is, of course, totally true about the major events of your life. Sutra 11 says that the stored karmic traces, the stored samskaras, determine where you're born, you know, what part of the world you're born in, the family you're born in, which, as you know, has enormous effect on every part of your life, the length of your life, and most of your basic experiences. So, and I would amend this by adding that it also determines the quality of your disposition, whether you're easygoing or uptight, whether you're optimistic or tend to be a glass half-empty person, and of course, your race, your relationship with your parents, the genes that cover basic intelligence, your major diseases, the quality of your mind, your talents, you know, your musical ability or your capacity to speak and your charm or lack of it, all these are part of the impressions in your Karmashaya. And often, you know, for those of you who are interested in astrology, the traces of them show up in your astrological chart. The emotions, the feelings, the states, the memories that are held in the Karmashaya will, under the right circumstances, bring up intense emotions, as we were saying earlier, that can completely derail your life. One of the things that I used to do some work in prison populations, and one of the things that people would sometimes say is that, you know, there was a moment of rage, and they punched somebody or even shot them, and here they are, you know, and it's just something that happened in a moment of intense emotion. I remember once getting a call from an old friend. He just met a woman whom he found very compelling, and he wanted to date her. And he said to me, she's trying to have a baby, and she's looking for a sperm donor, and I'm going to offer to be the father. And I heard this tone in his voice, which I have come to recognize as the tone of voice we get when we're being impelled by an intense samskara. And I said, I guess impelled by my own samskara, don't do it. You hardly know her. And he said, I'm doing it. And he did. They did. They made a baby. They moved in with each other. They tried to be a couple. They were actually not at all suited to each other, and the relationship caused a lot of grief before it finally ended. But it was also the occasion, of course, for this very beautiful being to come into the world, and also gave him some of the karmic baggage that he's probably going to have to carry because the relationship between his parents wasn't so great. But in hindsight, you know, you can see that there was some kind of karma, an agreement, a pre-existing arrangement, a debt. You know, karma is debt, essentially. One way or another, it's you know, something that, it's an obligation that we've created. And we, you know, and you can also see how much our, you know, our lives, our marriages are based on karmic agreements. You know, how even sometimes we fall in love almost as a way of getting us to stand still and undergo a karmic pattern that we have with somebody. So, and one of the great mysteries of karma, because when our basic ignorance, you know, not nearly always precludes us from knowing what's behind it. You know, what made you go to that party where you met your future partner? Why did you suddenly decide to eat at that restaurant where you got food poisoning that completely screwed up your gut for years after that? You know, why did your cousin get COVID when his wife didn't? You know, you may never have the answer to these questions, but what you can see is that certain meetings, certain apparent free choices are actually not random or even free. And by the way, if you really want to understand your past karma, the karma that you're working with in this lifetime, you don't really have to go to a psychic, you know, because psychics don't always get it right. All you really have to do is look at the issues you're dealing with in this lifetime, and you'll see what the karmic backpack has thrown up for you now. You know, and the other thing is, the most important thing to understand about your personal karma for people like you is that it's given you the opportunity to hear the truth and to practice it. And that means that you have earned it through actions and thoughts, probably in many lifetimes, and that the practices that you do in this lifetime, if nothing else, are going to ensure that you get to keep on doing sadhana in the future. In one of the beautiful emails that came in this week, a couple of people described how spiritual practice, which was hard and even exhausting at first, gradually became pleasurable. And, you know, this is the action of karma. Your positive actions are evolutionary drivers. And it's not only that your spiritual practice maintains, you know, it allows you to increase the momentum of your past practice and drive the process of self-realization. It also protects you from calamity. You know, it allows your worldly life to go better. And, you know, otherwise, when we aren't doing practice regularly, and I'm sure a lot of you have realized this, our lives are just the unfolding of our karmashaya, the constant unrolling of our visible and invisible karmic backpack. And when our practice isn't honing our mind, we forget, you know, how to stay steady. Karma is inexorable. It's a law in the universe like gravity. Actions always have consequences, and it's especially true, or perhaps some say only true, in this plane, which is why the earth plane is the place where souls go to evolve, because in other planes of existence, and again, I'm telling the story that the scriptures tell us, I haven't personally experienced this, but in other planes, apparently, there's no gap between thought and result. So you actually don't get to weigh your actions, look at the positive and negative effects of the consequences, and work with your own mind. We come here in order to grow, to change. There are supposedly four kinds of karma, and I think that's actually pretty apparent. There's the karma that we're living now. Well, let me backtrack a minute. Three of these kinds of karma are personal. The first is called Purusha Kara, the karma we're creating now. It's also called Kriyaman Karma, the actions that we are taking in the present moment. So this is our area of choice, and it's, of course, really important. Though, as I've said earlier, not all of our present karma is dictated by true choice. Some of it is just the rising of samskaras from the karmic backpack. The second kind of karma is called adrishta phala karma, karma that is the fruit of something unseen, that is, events and actions that are carried over from another life. And those are those events that I was speaking of earlier, where you're driven or impelled in some way. And another name for this is prarabdha karma, destined karma. And the third kind is called sanchita karma, the karma that's been stored, waiting to manifest later. But there's also another kind of karma, which is called yadrucha karma, which, that is, things that happen that are related, that are not the result of your samskaras, but that are random, dictated by chance, or come from external sources. You know, for instance, you might have been sitting on a plane next to a guy with COVID, and you get sick. There's nothing you did to get sick. You just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, or Arnaud Arbery, who was jogging and with nothing on his mind except getting some exercise, somebody came along and shot him. You know, this was, I mean, we don't know, of course, if this was part of his personal karmic backpack. Probably was. But we could also say it was a completely random event. You know, this is something I think most of you know, but karma it has its source in the mind and is in the will. And what makes an action have a particular effect is the motive with which we do it. And this brings us back to the kleshas. When we're acting out of the impulsion of ignorance and ego, we're already on the back foot when it comes to karma. But when we're acting out of attachment and aversion, things become very, very problematic. So, you know, one of the famous examples is the example of the surgeon and, you know, the mugger, the gangbanger. They both use a knife, and, you know, the person whom they take the knife to dies in this story, in this example. But one is motivated by healing, the other is motivated by greed or anger. And theoretically, the doctor is not karmically responsible for the patient who dies under his knife, though nowadays he might get sued for malpractice. But assuming he acted competently and in good faith, he's not karmically responsible for it. However, there is a big wrinkle here, which is that, first of all, almost all of us are fully identified with our bodies, our opinions, and certainly our professional skills. And we all have mixed motives for our actions. So the doctor may be motivated partly by altruism, partly by the fact that it's his job, partly by the desire to demonstrate his competence, and partly by pure ego, arrogance, or the desire to, you know, best another doctor, or he might have been having a bad day. For all of us, pretty much every thought and action that we have has a mixture of positive and negative motives in it. And that's why the results of our karmas are so mixed. You know, and so it's created by our intention, by our motivations. But above all, as we've been saying again and again, it's our ownership of our actions, our belief that we're a solid, substantial self, our belief that there's such a thing as a permanent I, a permanent personal self, that creates the karma. You know, for instance, a doctor who kills the patient without ever meaning to may spend the rest of his life feeling guilty about it because he identifies with the action. And, you know, and as long as you're identifying with this person and you're going to be motivated to some extent by attachment, aversion, and fear, and they're going to be mixed karmas. You know, a really good example is, you know, let's say you give $100 to Save the Children or to the candidate of your choice, and you do it because you want to help. You know, and at the same time, there's a part of you which wonders if you can afford it, you know, which thinks that if you hadn't given the money, you'd be able to afford that blouse that you want. And so, and part of you is, you know, kind of happy about the fact that you're such a generous person, which has its own karma. So among the traces left in your subtle body, there'll be the pleasure of making the offering, feeling useful. There'll be that trace of aversion from wishing you still had the money. There'll be the powerful yogic samskara that you've created by overcoming your aversion to giving to generosity. I mean, it's, you know, you've created a habit of generosity. And the way these karmas come to fruition is in, you know, we mentioned before the type of life you have, the type of experiences you have, and also the state of your mind. So, you know, I'll give you an example from a couple of the people I went to college with, actually. I went to a college where there were quite a few, it was a girls' college, and there were quite a few daughters of wealthy families who went there. And often they were extremely generous, especially giving to good causes, helping people who had problems. And they also had tremendous guilt about the fact that they had privileges that other people didn't have. Of course, this isn't true of all wealthy people. But when I began to understand the law of karma, I began to see that actually these situations are the result of mixed samskaras. You know, maybe they were very generous and noble and hardworking in previous lives, so they got to be born into money. But perhaps they were ungenerous or felt like undeserving or turned away people in need or who knows, and or felt avaricious about their money. So what they got in a sort of balanced way was a kind of inability to fully enjoy the privileges. You know, we are mixed bags, and that mixture of karmas is why our lives are so mixed, why our lives are so confusing. I want to just say one more thing, and then we're going to do a contemplation. In all the Hindu and Buddhist scriptures, and actually in the scriptures and the texts of other traditions as well, there's a lot of emphasis on making merit. That is, on doing actions that are going to increase your store of positive karmas. The Buddhists are really, really strong on this, and one of the things that they say is that there are certain actions that may or may not liberate you in and of themselves. You know, for instance, meditation will liberate you. Doing a ritual may not in itself liberate you. It will purify your mind and speech. But what it does is create a positive relationship, a generous relationship with the universe, which means that the generosity that you've exhibited towards the universe will come back to you. You know, so when you do regular Lakshmi Puja to help improve your money karma, and you also accompany it with practical actions, you often get a regular, you know, actually a, a measurable result. And the emphasis on creating merit in Hinduism and Buddhism is not just for the reasons of mundane success. It's also because the merit that you create through generous actions, through charity, through certain rituals, if you belong to that kind of culture, will help you in the moments when you're being invited into the state of enlightenment. And you just don't have the strength to fully surrender. I'm very serious. This is something that is said in many Buddhist texts, that, we come to this point, grace, the power of God, the power of the self, the power of the guru, however you connect to it, grace opens up the light. Grace opens up non-duality. It opens up the awakened state. But often, even if we've done a lot of practice, there's a hesitation or even a lack of the energy that it takes to fully push us into that state. And this is where our merit comes in, because the accumulated merit, the accumulation of your good actions, if you have really dedicated them to liberation and to the welfare of all beings, are going to come like a lift. They're going to lift you up and help you cross over. And they're also there, this is, of course, a very famous point, they also are there at death to help you get to a better state, both in the after-death realms and in your next life. I want to say one more thing about that. So take a few breaths. Don't want to hose you down with scriptural information. Just let yourself breathe into the heart. Feel the lotus of the heart opening with the inhalation. Let the inhalation draw your attention back through the back of the heart, through the back of the body, and connect to the grace of the divine backrest, the great heart. Ishwara, Ishwari at your back. And then allow the exhalation to flow the light and grace of that presence through your body and out through your pores. So one of the very beautiful things that Vyasa, the commentator on the Yoga Sutras, says is that intense spiritual practice, tapas, essentially, when performed with pure motives, can literally change reality. We talked about that a little bit last week. But, if you think about it in your own life, for instance, as you practice spiritual activism, which I know many people in the spiritual world are doing these days, using the power of imagination or prayer to help another person or to send peace or light or understanding into a difficult world situation, that it actually affects the environment. He also says that four things happen when you do intense practice with a sattvic motive and an intent to help. First, the forces of nature, that is sattva, the pure quality, rajas, the active quality, and tamas, the still quality, get realigned. For instance, in a difficult situation, people are often being driven by intense rajas, which leads to actions based on egoistic ambition and a drive to win. Or they're in a state of tamas, relatively paralyzed or confused. And when we practice and offer our practice into a situation, it allows the pure quality of sattva to overcome the egoic pushiness of rajas and the stasis and entropy of tamas. And I bet as you're listening, many of you are recognizing how this happened. It literally changes the energies in the situation. And one of the things that happens then is that it affects the currents of cause and effect. You know, I mean, we know from physics that action at a distance, what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, he didn't really accept it. But, you know, in that famous example is the example of how the butterfly flapping its wings in the South China Sea impacts the hurricane forming in the North Atlantic. In other words, action at a distance can completely change reality, sometimes instantaneously. So the realignment of causes and results occurs through practice. And intentional practice, the realignment of causes and results, intentional practice with an open heart, of course, activates the stored reservoir of karmas so that they come to support your present effort. I'd just like to ask you now to find a posture that's comfortable, relatively relaxed, but attentive. I'm going to ask you a contemplative question. And we'll start by focusing on the breath, because you really want to activate as much as possible your subtle intuition here. And we're going to start it tonight, and then I'm going to ask you to take it home with you. We'll do it as part of the homework. So looking at your life at this moment in time, at this particular period, what are the karmic circumstances that are up for you to deal with? Just ask the question and just notice what arises. What are the karmic circumstances that are up for you to deal with? Now, this may be a little harder. What are the samskaras that you notice arise when you're thickly inside one of these karmic circumstances? What are the mental and emotional tendencies that tend to arise? For some of you, this may be really obvious. For some of you, not so much. And if you have a pen and paper close to you, you might want to write something down. But don't let yourself get too much into thinking about it. You can have a chance to think about it during the homework assignment. But right now, we're going to do a Kriya Yoga practice. So take one of these karmic circumstances, and it can be one that seems kind of casually important, or it can be one that's really a big one, a really up one. And now allow your description or the felt sense of that karma to ride the breath into the heart and offer it into the presence at your back. And then with the exhalation, feel that the grace of that presence flows through your body, purifying and creating space within that karmic circumstance. Allowing any tension that's associated with it, or attachment or expectation or aversion, to just open up a little bit. Let the grace of the presence behind you breathe grace into that karmic circumstance and into the samskaras that surround it. And you know, when we practice with working with a karmic tendency in this way or in one of the other ways we do it, once you have actually done this practice of dissolving the karma into the back heart, realize that you have done that. In other words, even if the entire circumstance hasn't dissolved, something has. And you don't want to keep returning to it, because every time you return to it, you kind of reify it. You make it more concrete. So as we do these practices of offering karmic circumstances into the light of the goddess, the light of Ishwara, the light of presence, just know that the offering has been received and we don't have to take it back. So one of the really interesting kind of tantric points that Vyasa speaks about in the commentary on Sutra 3 is that Kriya Yoga breaks the afflictions into pieces. It weakens their strength. It purifies them. And when it does, it transforms them into pure Shakti, pure power. In other words, the qualities of the kleshas, once they're purified, become sources of power. Now, how does this work? When avidya is transformed in the mind, it becomes what the Buddhists call not knowing mind, the mind that is only aware of itself, that doesn't hold opinions, that isn't attached to its descriptions of reality, that is simply able to experience itself as what it is, which is pure consciousness. And when a mind that is only aware of itself actually becomes an extraordinary power, because it can conceive of anything and it can also expand to include everything. So when asmita is transformed into the ego of identifying with pure consciousness, you have the power of consciousness moving through your sense of self. And the clarity and the love, I know that some of you have had this experience, the clarity and the love that you experience in that moment is unbelievable. It's ecstasy. And, you know, when attachment to ordinary enjoyment becomes a subtle attachment to your own Shakti or to your higher awareness, it draws you more and more into realms of joy and light. And when aversion to ordinary discomfort begins to become this subtle aversion to the inner energies, both in yourself and others, that cause pain, this is when aversion becomes actually the goad of the goddess. You know, if you see some of the iconography of the goddess, she often has an elephant goad in her hand, and that goad is the prick of aversion to the things that take you out of your purest experience of reality of life. So an abhinivesha, the clinging to life, when it's purified, it can actually turn into the ability to move through the seams of reality in a state of total alertness, because we are pervaded by life force, by Shakti, in such a way that we can be completely guided. So all of these qualities, you know, which cause so much pain, also have their divine side. And when we do the practices of Kriya Yoga, they not only attenuate the kleshas, they actually bring out the divine power that is in them, that is behind them. They increase your Shakti. When we don't, we get kind of stuck. I'm compelled to tell this story. It's one of my favorite karma stories. In the early 80s, when my guru was in the United States, the charismatic head of a radical political movement came to meet him with a group of his followers. He and his followers were very, very moved by Muktananda, and they came often. They had a lot of private meetings with him, and I got to sit in on some of them. The head of the group was facing second-degree murder charges and was hoping that some sort of higher power would help him escape prison. And I remember asking Baba whether this man could mitigate his circumstances through practice and grace. He looked into the distance and he said, "Some karmas are too strong. They have to be lived through. But the experience of the truth that he's having now will allow him to live through it in a way that he doesn't make a new circumstance." And the interesting thing was that other members of that same group who had less intense karma actually had the experience over years of practice that every part of their lives became better, and that the work that they had been doing with this movement became more and more empowered because of their state, and really began to reach into the mainstream educational system and, you know, a lot of other places. So karma happens like this. You know, it's a mixed bag, and it is the greatest source of our power and our evolution. I want to end this class with a fairly intense sutra that Vyasa seems to believe is the fundamental rationale for why yoga is so important. It's about the inevitability of suffering for somebody who doesn't recognize the path. Parinamata pasamuskara. Sorry. Parinamata pasam samskara dukher gunavriti virodacha dukameya sarvam vivekina. From the vantage point of a discriminating person, the word used here is a person of viveka, of wisdom, all is pain because everything is subject to change, distress, karmic impressions, and mutually contradicting forces of nature. And here's the thing, you know, we have this amazing ability to make ourselves happy, even in very difficult circumstances. It's one of the great superpowers of human beings. And we have it because ananda, sheer joy, is intrinsic to us, it's innate in us. But our ability to tap into our own ananda largely depends on how much access we have to our shaktis, to our inner powers of strength and stamina. And, you know, the beings of the Yoga Sutras recognize that yoga is a practice for freeing our shaktis, and that when we settle for partial satisfaction but don't allow ourselves to really look beyond the pleasures we use to medicate ourselves, we're actually keeping ourselves on the hamster wheel, because as we eventually discover, as the song says, all good things come to an end. You know, even the sattvic ones. And when they end, we experience pain. And most of that pain comes from our own reactive feelings. So in the Yoga Vasishtha, there's a story about a strange creature who wanders about the world beating himself with sticks. And it's a parable, and the sage says that that strange creature is the mind, which keeps beating itself up with worries and cravings and anger and resentment, and then it exhausts itself, and it falls down in a swoon, and then it thinks it's experiencing peace. So everything changes constantly. Your moods change, your relationships, your health conditions. That means that everything we count on is eventually going to disappear except our own self. That's just painful. The second reason is that simply that our level of internal and external discomfort increases as we get older, as the body, as the organs start to wear out. Especially true in the current world, because things are changing so rapidly that we're often, you know, caught in a reality that is no longer the reality. You know, I can't remember how many times I've heard someone say, you know, things are really different now. This is the new normal. It's not going to go back to the way it was. And yet we cling to our expectations and assumptions. And so that keeps us from actually flowing with change. Of course, the third cause of pain is just our habit patterns, you know, the way we beat ourselves up in the course of life. Because all through our lives, the karmic patterns are bearing fruit. And if we're not practicing to notice them and transform them, negative samskaric patterns seize hold of the cycle many times a day. And I know you know what I mean, because some of you write into the listserv about this, and I know what I mean because I, too, experience the effects of a bad mood or a sense of discouragement. And this, of course, is particularly true when the body breaks down. So Vyasa explains all this to us in that sutra, and then in that Sutra 15, and then in Sutra 16, which is, I have to say, my favorite sutra. He says, Patanjali says, the pain that is to come can and should be avoided. In other words, there's hope. We don't have to experience all that. As we learn to detach consciousness, the field of awareness, from identifying with the klesha-driven, samskara-filled mind, your consciousness can reveal itself as completely open, completely pure, completely clear seeing. And at a certain point, and again, I'm going to ask you to do this week, as you get into a clear state, you start to notice those samskaras that are particularly seductive, that grab you every time. And once you can notice them and stand aside from them and not immediately identify with them, then you have power over your samskaras, and then everything can change. And that's the work. That's the work. As one great Buddhist master says, if we examine how constantly we personalize everything, how we relate everything to its effect on our own egoic mind, we'll see that the real source of our misery is the failure to manage, educate, and transform our mental states. So I hope this class on the kleshas and the negative effects of karma was not too depressing. We're moving into the antidotes once again. And now we're going to use the power of our own karma, our own ability to use the mind and will for the purpose of liberation. We're going to combine it with the power of Ishwara, the power of pure presence, the power of the benevolent force of consciousness. And just allow ourselves to sit in the beauty of who we are, which is never touched. And also to begin the process of connecting the light of our own awareness, the light of our own mind, with the presence who holds and supports us and supports us. So find your posture. Inhale and let the sits bones and buttocks become heavier and heavier, sinking into the seat. Allow the scapular muscles to draw your torso upwards so that you become taller. Your head rises to the ceiling. Your shoulder blades clasp the back. And the breath flows with full consciousness. And this time we're going to imagine that the breath is flowing in horizontally as though through an opening in the chest wall. And if that seems too weird to you, of course, follow the breath as it flows through the nostrils, recognizing that the breath is being drawn to caress the heart lotus, the soft fingers of your prana shakti, touching and opening the space of the lotus of the heart, touching the radiance of your inner light. And as you settle into the heart, you can allow the breath to begin to move through the back body, to connect to the presence behind you, to open to allowing the light of your own heart to be drawn into the divine presence, the God, Goddess, Ishwara, Ishwari, Source, Shakti, Love, who stretches out infinitely behind you and around you. And allow the inhalation to become an offering of your light into that great heart light, and the exhalation to draw the radiance of the great heart through your body, irradiating your individuality and flowing out through your pores into the world.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च പ്രാണസംഗോന വൈ പഞ്ചവായു നവാസപ്തധാകൂർണവാ പഞ്ചകോശാ നവാ പാണിപാദം ന ചോപസ്ഥപായു ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം നമേ ദ്വേഷരാഗൌ ലോഭമോഹൌ മദോനൈവ മേനൈവ മാത്സര്യഭാവ ന ധർമ്മോന ചാർത്ഥോന കാമോന മോക്ഷ ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ന പുണ്യം ന പാപം ന സൗഖ്യം ന ദുഃഖം ന മന്ത്രോ ന തീർത്ഥം ന വേദ ന യജ്ഞ അഹം ഭോജനം നൈവ ഭോജ്യം ന ഭോക്ത ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം അഹം നിർവികൽപോ നിരാകാരരൂപോ വിഭൂത്വാച്ച സർവത്ര സർവേന്ദ്രിയാണ നചാസംഗതം നൈവ മുക്തേനമേയ ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം ശിവോഹം ചിദാനന്ദരൂപാ ശിവോഹം 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 ശിവോഹം.